Well, DNA, it's natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life, each one dependent on another, and so the circle it closed up tight. But then along came a man in a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows, they grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Brian Stark in Genetically Modified World to introduce today's show. We'll begin in Portland, where hundreds of Oregonians removed asphalt pavement and plan to replace it with urban farms, trees, and native vegetation. We also hear about the latest assault on our food, or at least on our ability to know what is in our food and how to maintain that basic right. Finally, we talk with poets Jack Hirschman and Agneta Folk, who recently returned from Basra, Iraq, where they met and mingled with Iraqi poets and poets from all over the world, all there to share their poetry and support one another in that mysterious and wonderfully creative world of poetry.
But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours unheard. And now when you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Yeah, get up.
Bob Marley and Get Up, Stand Up to give a big hooray to Portland, Oregon, where last week hundreds of people helped to break and remove asphalt from 300 square foot of parking lot in Portland. It was the 8th Towards Carefree Cities conference that kicked off last Monday. Removing asphalt was in collaboration with the Fargo Garden Project and dpave.org. These groups promote the removal of unnecessary concrete and asphalt from urban areas. They say paved surfaces contribute to rainwater carrying toxic urban stormwater and pollutants to local streams and rivers, and that pavements also disconnect people from the natural world. They replace pavement with urban farming, as I say, planting trees, native vegetation, and adding beauty to restoring nature. Here's what it sounded like in Portland last week.
About 3,000 square feet of underutilized, ugly asphalt, and we're going to put in a community gathering space and garden where we're going to be growing lots of different kinds of fruit trees and berries and vines.
It was a property that was slated for development. We actually were looking at putting a triplex, a new build on it. DPave approached me about turning it into a green space, and it just kind of seemed a no-brainer to me.
And it's clean asphalt. So like it or not, this asphalt will be recycled and reused again on other pavement surfaces. It's important to know that what we're ripping up is an asphalt parking lot that had no infiltration capacity prior to this. Stuff would just run off into the streets, contribute to our sewer overflow problems we have here in Portland.
The idea is to try and make sure more things don't get paved that shouldn't get paved, and try and rip up some of the pavement that's already there. And we've started with some small projects and some yards, but we want to go bigger and bigger and bigger. So this is the first bigger that we're doing.
When you think about what our major tasks are in urban areas, is the reclaiming the commons. And the biggest common space we have is covered in asphalt. It's all the streets of every city, which is a really dumb use of the land. And so the deep paving agenda, which is only in its very nascent stage, is just beginning to be taken seriously by at least some subcultures. It was going to become a very big task ahead of us. And when we start talking seriously about urban food forests, we really need to talk about taking up the asphalt and starting to think about it as places to grow food.
I moved to Portland about a year ago, and this is the reason why I moved to Portland, for stuff like this.
We're ahead of schedule. We have plans to fill about four of these boxes. We've already filled one box, and the second one's filling fast. we're actually probably going to have to take a break because Flannery, which is the company that's going to be recycling the asphalt for us, can't get trucks out that fast for us. So we're incredible with the energy we're throwing at this task, and it's really exciting to see. I can already hear the earth breathing again underneath this asphalt.
I've been breaking up asphalt with big pry bars. Got some huge chunks of asphalt into those dumpsters. Then we began scooping up the gravel, nice clean gravel. It can be reused elsewhere. And now I'm shuffling wheelbarrows. It's been a great experience, and I'm kind of exhausted.
The theme of the conference is rethinking mobility, rediscovering proximity, and for me this deep paving project just neatly encapsulates all of that. We're saying we don't need a place to drive to, we don't need a place to park our cars, we need a place that can be in our neighborhood and be somewhere that we want to be in and that we want to walk by.
A perennial food forest is our vision for the site over here. In this corner, we're going to have a small patio so people can come out and actually enjoy this. And we're ultimately, our goal is to turn a community eyesore into a community asset.
That was the sound of people breaking up and removing asphalt from a 300-square-foot parking lot in Portland, Oregon.
Well, now the corporations, they will tell you it's about feeding people in need. But it isn't really very hard to see that it's really just about corporate greed. They patent the food in the third world, and then they watch their profits grow. And the third world people can't say no. They're being blackmailed by the WTO. And now their food crops grow on the ocean floor. Cows, they grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray. In our genetically modified world. In our genetically modified...
Brian Stark and Genetically Modified World as we turn to... our next segment on food. If you have not seen the movie Food Inc. yet, here are a couple of clips to warm us up for our next segment.
Remember when food was food? Mom made it, maybe Dad carved it, you ate it. Simple, right? But that was before food, what's in it, what's good for you, turned into an argument. And this movie, Food Inc., a film designed to make you scared and angry about the food served up by the U.S. food industry.
The animals stand ankle deep in their manure all day long.
How much of it is really true? Every frame, according to the filmmakers.
They don't want us as consumers to think about how our food is grown and what's in it.
When filmmaker Robbie Kenner says they, he means the handful of major American food companies that he and his collaborator Eric Schlosser claim are pursuing very scary practices in a very secretive way.
It's really just three or four companies that are controlling the meat. We've never had food companies this big and this powerful in our history.
I think just the fact that we're talking about where our food comes from is not in their interests, ultimately. And that was something, you know, I think they like the illusion that all our food comes from farms like this.
Like this, the Stone Barn Center for Agriculture, where we met up outside New York City, a showcase for a style of farming that they say in their movie is the cultural opposite of how most American supermarket food is produced. The result, they say, Americans don't really know what they're eating.
We don't know when dangerous bacteria are in our food. It's not being labeled. We don't know what sort of testing it's gone under.
We don't know when cloned animals are in our food. It's not being labeled.
Filled with images of what it describes as mistreated animals, unsanitary conditions, abusive workers, the movie now produced a vigorous response from the food industry.
I've been in this industry for 18 years, and for me, watching that movie was like going to see a documentary about modern investigative techniques and having Scooby-Doo show up on the screen. It was a caricature.
the poultry industry, where the movie explains that breeding has created a chicken significantly larger than it was 50 years ago. Not that they say this makes it dangerous to eat, but what's it like for the chickens? They visit a farmer who used to raise chickens for Purdue.
A lot of these chickens here, they can take a few steps and then they plop down. It's because they can't keep up with all the weight that they're carrying.
The film also goes to supermarkets and uses arguments that have long been made by writer Michael Pollan, who is featured prominently throughout Food, Inc.
There's a scene in the film where you look at a supermarket and you say that basically when you wander the aisles of a supermarket, you find yourself back in a cornfield in Iowa.
You know, when I started looking around the supermarket and following the food back to its source, what really surprised me is how much of that food in the supermarket and the fast food outlet is corn. Doesn't look like corn, it's not called corn, but those are the raw materials from which it's made. I mean, the Twinkie, the meat, the beef, the chicken, the pork, all fed on corn. The shine on the cover of the magazines at the checkout, made from corn. It's everywhere. Corn has taken over the food system. We need between 50 and 100 different chemical compounds to be healthy. You're not going to get all that from a diet of processed corn.
There are some important voices missing in Food, Inc., namely the big corporations, who the filmmakers repeatedly tell us were invited to be interviewed but did not accept the invitation.
It makes me wonder, how hard did you really push them to get into the movie? I mean, how much, was it one phone call, or did you try again and again?
We had numerous phone calls with many of these corporations, and far more corporations than we list in the film as having declined.
I think there was some concern about whether the makers of this particular movie were going to present a fair image.
Richard Lobb heads the National Chicken Council, representing the major chicken producers.
Would the companies have been better off if they had actually sat down for interviews with the filmmakers?
In retrospect, I wish we had offered them more access to the farm level so they could see it for themselves.
The truth, Lobb said, is in this video that he took a few days ago in a Delaware chicken house. Janet Riley of the American Meat Institute made a similar argument for the beef industry.
We're the only sector of animal agriculture that has a federal law that places strict requirements on how we handle livestock, and we can be shut down for failure to comply.
The documentary then takes us to the California state legislature, where there was a debate regarding the labeling of meat from cloned animals.
These cloned animals are a fundamentally new thing, but I find it incredible that the FDA not only wants to allow the sale of meat from cloned animals without further research, but also wants to allow the sale of this meat without any labeling.
We think that before you put a label on, you've got to educate the consumer about the technology, because there has been a lot of, you know, alarmist reporting about what I think people do perceive cloning to be, cloning of the meat or cloning of the animal as opposed to cloning of the embryo.
But that's saying that consumers are dumb.
And no, it's not saying
But consumers, they're able to make choices based on what's on the label. But you're saying consumers will be scared if the meat says, I think you're saying consumers would be frightened by
They'd
a label that says
cloned. They'd be frightened if they're not given information to help them. It's
would
not
you
in
eat
my
cloned
purview.
Meat?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Not understanding?
I understand enough to know that it's safe, but I can't explain the technology
but
to you.
Why not let the, if you can do it, why can't the typical consumer be as wise and discerning as you are?
They
and,
can.
And know, because the label says that the meat is from a cloned animal or not.
They can be if we work to educate them.
Five rodeos.
The film also makes an economic argument that the faster, bigger, cheaper way of producing food has put Americans on a diet of overwhelmingly inexpensive fast food.
Now that I know that the food is really unhealthy for us, I feel guilty giving it to my kids.
I objected to the idea that somehow these people were being forced to buy certain foods and forced to eat in their cars. I actually went online because I didn't believe it. And I was able to put together three different meals for under $18, $16 to $18, and I can guarantee you there'd be leftovers from what I cooked.
The movie offers an alternative vision of how we should be producing and eating food, slow food.
Hey, Piggles.
But with organic farming, there is a price. At the cash register, it's more expensive.
As we get in touch with the cost of growing food this way. The cost to the public health, the cost to the treasury because of all the subsidies, the cost to the environment. I think people will realize, well, maybe we should spend a little bit more money on food.
I don't think you can honestly say to the American people that, hey, you know, suck it up, pay more for your food. I don't think that's a viable approach to the agricultural economy.
I am less concerned about the movie now, and I'm more concerned about the longer-term impact, about it being used in schools without another point of view.
But at least all sides are talking now, and that's what Eric, Robbie, and Michael wanted all along.
Now, in the same way that candidates debate issues, I think companies should engage in a dialogue with people who disagree with some of their business practices.
I'm John Donvan for Nightline in New York.
Those were excerpts from the film Food Inc. with Robert Kenner, the filmmaker, and Eric Schlosser, author, along with Janet Riley, speaking from the point of view of the American Meat Institute. Some background on how food standards work. The Codex Alimentarius, which is Latin for food code or the food book, is a collection of internationally recognized standards, codes of practice, guidelines, and other recommendations relating to foods, food product, and food safety. The Codex Alimentarius Commission was established in 1963 by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Health Organization, and is recognized by the World Trade Organization as an international reference point for the resolution of disputes concerning food safety and consumer protection. The Codex, as it is known officially, covers all foods, whether processed, semi-processed, or raw, but far more attention has been given to foods that are marketed directly to consumers. In addition to standards for specific foods, the Codex contains general standards covering matters such as food labeling, food hygiene, food additives, and pesticide residues, and procedures for assessing the safety of foods derived from modern biotechnology. It also contains guidelines for the management of official, that is, governmental, import and export inspection and certification systems for foods. The Codex states that its main aims are protecting the health of consumers and ensuring fair practices in the international food trade. The overall controversy over the Codex relates to a perception that it is a mandatory standard for food safety, including vitamin and mineral supplements. Supporters of the Codex say that it is a voluntary reference standard for food and that there is no obligation on countries to adopt Codex standards. They argue that the use of the Codex during international disputes does not exclude the use of other references or scientific studies as evidence of food safety and consumer protection. Opponents, on the other hand, say that the Codex is recognized by the World Trade Organization as the international reference standard for the resolution of disputes concerning food safety and consumer protection. So why does this matter? Well, on May 3rd, coming up, Obama officials from the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, and the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA, will travel to a special meeting to propose that Codex reject common sense labeling laws regarding genetically modified foods or GMO food products. This means that if the U.S. government has its way, the powerful intergovernmental group Codex may soon make it impossible to label food, quote, GMO free, unquote, for any country in the world. There is a letter circulating online to FDA Deputy Commissioner of Food Michael Taylor and USDA Deputy Secretary Kathleen Merrigan asking that they not stifle international and U.S. regulations regarding the labeling of GMO food, since it is important that Americans know how their food is grown and we have a right to know what's in our food. The U.S. government should not be working to hamper these basic rights. The letter states, quote, as you know, America's food system is broken as a result of giant corporations continuing to fight against common sense regulations that would protect Americans for unsafe food and our right to know where our food comes from, unquote. So if you want to know more about this letter and sign it, I will have a link on our website, raisingsandradio.org, for you. And you can go there, raisingsandradio.org, to sign. But you can also go to the website itself for this group, which is foodfordemocracynow.org, and learn more about the whole issue. So that's foodfordemocracynow.org to learn more, or go to raisingsandradio.org to sign the letter. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments on Tuesday in its first ever case involving genetically modified crops. Its decision may significantly impact the future of genetically modified foods and government oversight of GMO food and other environmental issues. The case, Monsanto Corporation versus Gerson Seed Farms, revolves around an herbicide-resistant alfalfa that has been banned in the U.S. since 2007, when a federal court prohibited the multinational Monsanto from selling the seeds. That decision found that the U.S. Department of Agriculture did not do a thorough enough study of the impacts that GM alfalfa would have on human health and the environment, and ordered the agency to do another environmental impact statement review. The law under which organic farmers were allowed to challenge USDA's oversight of the GM alfalfa, the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, is what may suffer the most from the Supreme Court's eventual decision, which is expected in June at the earliest. The law requires federal agencies to integrate environmental values into their decision-making processes by considering the environmental impacts of their proposed actions and reasonable alternatives to those actions. Many concerned groups have joined the plaintiffs by filing amicus briefs against Monsanto in this case. Doug Gurian-Sherman is a senior scientist at the Food and Environmental Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists, and he said, quote, "The big issue here is how much deference should be given to a regulatory agency and its expertise in doing its job versus how much access or deference should be given to the public in having the ability to challenge the agency in court." Gurian-Sherman has serious concerns about the agency's actions on GM crops generally. Quote, "There's been several indications besides this case that USDA has not been really doing an adequate job regulating genetically engineered seed. As a scientist, having reviewed a number of environmental assessments that the agency has done, in my opinion, they've often done a very lax, scientifically often unsupportable job in their analyses. It's not like they've been completely negligent, but in my opinion, they've made a number of errors in either scientific reasoning or in their data or data analysis. Since 1992, USDA's APHIS division has granted non-regulated status to GM plants in response to 80 petitions, including multiple variations of corn, soybeans, cotton, rapeseed, potato, tomato, squash, papaya, plum, rice, sugar beet, tobacco, alfalfa, flax, and chicory. Tuesday's Supreme Court decision will influence what else is on that list in the future.
Now in the corporation's own creation, with who shall we worship then? With the First United Church of Syngenta.
I'm Susan Gallimore with Raising Sand Radio, and you can learn more about the progressive issues we air by visiting our website, Raising Sand Radio, where you can link to organizations and reports mentioned in our weekly show that broadcasts a wide range of progressive views and ideas, and we try to do it in collaboration with you. You're always encouraged to email me at susan@raisingsandradio.com and let me know what you think of our shows, or give us ideas for shows, or give us contacts for people you think would be worth interviewing. And again, you go to our website, raisingsandradio.org, and you can find any of our shows downloadable, so see the sorts of shows that we like to do. And if you have information or contacts, share them with us. We are a very small operation, always looking for a handout. Please consider contributing to our work, and you can do that by clicking on the PayPal button on our website, raisingsandradio.org, and being as generous as you can be in these difficult times. We are a part of the MotherSpeak Media Project, and that is MotherSpeak.org is fiscally sponsored by the Peace Development Fund. So all of your donations are also tax deductible. If you'd like to get something in return for your generosity, your donation, you can purchase my book, Long Time Passing, Mothers Speak About War and Terror, in which I share the stories of families in Palestine and look at the day-to-day realities they face there, but also share stories from Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Lebanon, and the United States. An author autographed hard copy edition of the book is available to you as a premium with a donation of $50 to Raising Sand Radio and our parent organization, MotherSpeak. Again, go to the website, raisingsandradio.org, to order and to help us air progressive ideas and themes like this week's show. Our listeners come from all over the world, as you know. If you listen in from a land far from the U.S., say Norway or Armenia or South Africa or Russia or West Bank or Australia or Canada or France, we have listeners from all over the place. China also. Moreover, Raising San Radio is a labor of love and concern for people over profit, but today's dire circumstances are also a matter of practical survival. If you can't donate financially, donate time or just let us know that our work is appreciated. Again, the website raisingsandradio.org with the PayPal button. And again, we're fiscally sponsored by Peace Development Fund. And my email is susan@raisingsandradio.org.
But I'll sing a song for Basra.
That's The Song for Basra by Dave Rovix, as we turn to poets Jack Hirschman and Agneta Folk, who traveled to Basra, Iraq, to mix and mingle and share poetry with Iraqi poets as well as many others from around the world. We begin with Agneta Folk describing the festival.
Al Marbit is a poetry festival that's been going for 7 years, but this was the very first time they invited foreign poets. So there was great excitement around that.
We first received an invite for Muniam al-Fakir, who obviously is connected with the cultural ministry in Iraq, but lives in Denmark. And we responded to that, said we'd be interested. Yeah. And then we learned later that Maram al-Masri had recommended us and a few other poets from who had been here in San Francisco.
This has been going on for 7 years now, so this means that this festival has been continuing through the war and in Basra?
Yes, always in Basra.
Always in Basra. But it's mostly been Iraqis?
Yes, from Arab countries, not just Iraqis, other Arab countries. Okay. We were the first ones to come from the West, so to speak.
Okay. Yeah. So before we go on to the actual content of the festival itself, can we talk a little bit about the fact that this has been going on through the last several years of intense warfare?
There were 2 years that they didn't have it during those seven.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
okay.
There were 2 years that because of the war they couldn't hold it.
And what does Basra look like at this point?
I thought it was very, very decimated. You can actually really tell that many wars have gone on. There was a very bleak feeling around the place, though I suppose in normal times it probably can look, you know, that kind of desert country anyway. But everywhere there was a lot of garbage piled up. But you could also see new constructions coming up here and there. Very clapped out cars, very, very austere looking, in fact. Even the palm trees were they looked grey, don't you think? Do you remember looking through the window?
Yes, Basra is a city, not unlike, say, places in San Francisco, that is three floors, it's not high rises. We didn't see many high rises in Basra. And there was a bleak gray. It's not the image that you have of a desert town where there is golden sands or things. It wasn't that way at all.
Color of concrete.
That's right. That was closer to it. It was the color of concrete. Mm. That's right. And a dusty feeling about it. A desert dusty feeling.
And the people?
I particularly was interested in the women. Of course, wherever you looked, you saw women in hijabs or nijabs, you know, the full black outfit. And in fact, before we went, I read up about Basra because I was, like all of us, concerned about the security. But what I specifically noted was that in the last year, 40 women were killed in Basra because they were not wearing the right kind of clothes or makeup, etc. You saw these women in clusters, you know, like black shadows through the streets. And the other thing, of course, which I knew before, but I noticed it particularly in this case, that the affection between men, you know, men would walk hand in hand and they would walk up and embrace each other and kiss each other. And the woman was never in that kind of proximity of a man or being touched in public, which I knew but had not seen.
We should mention, because this occurred right at the beginning, we got our visas at Basra Airport, originally they sent him to Washington, but we had no money to get from San Francisco to Washington to pick up our visas. So it was arranged on a different air route that we'd get our visas in Basra Airport. And we were met by people from the cultural ministry and poets, a couple of poets. And then we were met in the airport by Saba Jassim. Saba Mohsen Jassim was the poet that I invited in 2007 to come to the San Francisco International Festival. He was given a big run around and he had to get his visa. He had to go to Damascus, apply for the visa and go to and wait 23 days. They told him the visa was ready a week before the festival here in San Francisco, but they did not give him the visa till the last day of the festival. And it was done by Washington, that we learned. Washington, well, I think it was because he's a communist, for one thing, and they were not so eager to have him come to the country. But now things are somewhat different in one sense. I mean, the communist newspaper is published, two newspapers. The communists got 4 votes in parliament in Baghdad in the recent elections. And indeed, he came out to greet us. He was there at the airport, and he greeted, and it was great for us to see Saba finally, because we really love him. Yeah. And we've loved him for years in the distance, you see. So, and he was our translator. He translated Aggie's work and my work, and he read with us in the different venues.
He's an amazing man, actually. He's a teacher, former English teacher. And he has 4 children. And his wife, some years ago, had a very serious during an operation for something minor, everything went wrong. So she's severely incapacitated. She can't move. When we started communicating with him, he wrote about Selma, and we would love Selma back to life. And there was this enormous warmth in this man's demeanor that really caught our attention. And also his English was very good. He read our translations in the festival, and in fact, when he read mine from a shorter poem, I thought, my goodness, he's going on and on and on. The poem seemed much longer than my little version. So I asked my interpreter, did he really read my poem? He said, yes, he did, she said, but I think he took some liberties. And it was so funny.
There were poets who came from Spain, Italy, Morocco, Syria, the United States, and that was among the countries. And most read 2 or 3 poems. I read 2 poems of mine, and I read an introduction which I'd written for the festival last year. I don't know if it was read at the festival. It was a solidarity with the people of San Francisco and the Almoravid Festival, and we just changed the date. Added a year. It was a general solidarity in relation to poetry as liberty, human liberty. And so I read that. And of course, Saba had translated that. And so he read that with and then read the poems. And then the next night he read Aggie's poems.
When we arrived on the very first day to the first part of the 3-day festival, we walked into this hall where we had been taken by, you know, heavy security, always surrounded by army, the Iraqi army, young boys. Anyway, we walked into this big hall and there were masses of children and they were singing and cheering us. And it was so heartwarming, and you could feel this warmth just pouring towards you. I mean, we all started to laugh and almost cry. It was that sweet. And then we walked into the hall, and of course, there were lots of speeches. It was very, very official in the end. It was a national anthem, and then there was a dance troupe. They were just, you know, pulling out all the stops to give us the flavor of Iraqi culture. And then the readings started, and we were divided into 3 days. So there were so many foreign ones on the first day and so on. And we're sitting in this huge hall, and at the front, we sit in comfortable sofas, of course. Everyone's smoking inside. It's extraordinary to see this, you know. So between each poet, I rather liked it. It was not really any introduction to speak of this. The next and the next. Mm-hmm. But there was kind of music, Iraqi music and sometimes Moroccan, mm-hmm. playing in and out and then the next. It was very beautiful.
Mm-hmm. I would have imagined that the Iraqi content content of their poetry would be fairly driven by events there at this point. Is that accurate?
Yes, mm-hmm. certainly there's that. And also there's traditional. The traditional love poetry. Needless to say, I don't know Arabic, and I did not have a translator, so much of it, at times Saba would mention something when we were sitting and talking. Saba would mention something, a poem that was written, that was speaking about this particular situation in Iraq, but also situations in the world too, outside Iraq.
In Arab culture, poetry is the highest level of attainment.
That's right.
There's a lot of engineers, a lot of doctors, and they all want to be poets.
That's right. As I said earlier, I had this woman, Neda, who actually lived in England for 11 years. So she translated into my ear, so I actually wrote down some lines. So this is like a collage, if you like, from different poets. So the first one was, his name was Mohammed, and he said, "Where still I go with my sad memories." And then I couldn't hear what she said. But his poetry was banned in the war, I learned, but his voice was really powerful. Then another poet, "In the East all the houses look the same. The heart is still the size of my palm." Those are two independent lines. About the war in Iraq, a lot of the poetry contained actually memories from being tortured under Saddam Hussein. And frequently, they were talking about how for the very first time they could speak freely, and they meant since Saddam Hussein and had been toppled. And there was an enormous relief, and they said it again and again. We could never sit like this. There would be a microphone under the chair, or if you went to the hairdresser, might be spy, etc. Mm-hmm. Let me just say a few lines more. "I always tell my children, don't love your children more than us. We are the saving bank of love." And then, "My grandfather breathes the sad air, long nights polluted with slaughtered injuries." Remember, this was just talked into my ear, so she obviously didn't. "Please do not die. We try to create life because we are addicted to craziness. And this city gave up so many martyrs through war. Their dreams were broken." And this one I actually really liked. It was a poem about a grieving for his mother. "My heart was not made of stone. She was standing at the window, and he saw her hair fly away." And I think that's very beautiful. I have more, but...
I wrote some notations myself, and I'll read a few. "After the first venue, the first night's venue, which was in Petroleum Cultural Center Hall, a vast dome building that's where the children were. They greeted us at the outside when we entered. And at the venue, after the first venue, the bus took the poets to the riverside statue of Shaker Bader, or the name Al-A-Sa'ayab, an impressive towering monument to one of the founders, with two women, Nazika Malaka and Lameya Abbas Omara, two women writing in other parts of Iraq, working independently and simultaneously, they are the ones who created the free verse movement in Iraq, which began in the 1940s. From that statue and across the Arab River, one could see Iran, because Basra is right near the border of Iran. It was 3 kilometers away across the river. And I should say that the other guest poets were included two from Italy, Anna Lombardo and Alberto Mazzola, Eric Sana from France, though he lives at present in Uruguay, Kamal Ahlaki from Morocco, Seya Andersen and Kristen Bjørnkifler from Denmark, Bayan al-Safadi from Syria, Murillo de Miguel and Angel Petizme of Spain, and Osman Seviksoy, Nekdet Karasevda, Imdat Absar, Ayten Mutlu, and Ali Akbas from Turkey. There were 5 from Turkey. Apparently, the poems I'd read at that first one appeared on national television the next morning, and I was asked to read at the translation school of the University of Basra on the second day. I thought the request was part of the festival, but apparently heads had to get together, security-wise, because the university was not on the festival venue. But I was cleared to read to a large group of about 150 in a hall at the university. At that event, I read a whole ensemble of poems, including New York, New York, and Mother, but it was the Kunceros Arcane, which I'd written about the war in Iraq, that gave me one of the greatest pleasures of my life, reading it to those incredibly receptive students of the English language. It was my own personal highlight of the festival, but the collective sense of harmony and poetry at the festival is what has made Almadabid such an international wonder. Because this was the first year. Afterward, I was told by Kadin Al-Ali, the professor of that large class, that I had been the first poet from another country to read at the translation school in 7 years. In this country, we did not know about Almadabid. The last 2 years, for example, in the last 3 years, Almadabid has gone on, but I knew about it, but people in the United States, because Almadabid was never, it's never mentioned. It's censored whenever it occurs. They never tell you in the American newspapers anything that goes on in Iraq that's something apart from the war.
Remind our listeners, we're talking with Agneta Folk and Jack Hirschman, San Francisco poets who were recently in Basra. That was in March, wasn't it?
In March, yes.
And Jack, just talk a little bit about some of his highlights. Agneta, what about you? What were highlights for you?
Well, apart from the whole thing being there and not actually almost believing being there, because, you know, one has just read and heard so much about the atrocities going on there, I was just fascinated. I was particularly interested, of course, being a woman, I was interested in the women poets. There were, in fact, more than I thought. Every day there was a few represented, and they mainly read in hijab, but with enormous passion. I mean, it was extraordinary. And curiously enough, there was one poet who was Swedish. I mean, she was born in Iraq, but she'd moved to Sweden for obvious reasons. She was threatened or whatever. So, in fact, I spoke Swedish with her, and she read a very, very passionate poem about the situation, also about being an immigrant. I think the most memorable time for me was not after the festival, as we were leaving. We didn't even know we were going there. It was to a religious site outside of Basra. Can you remember what it was called?
Yes, it was a mosque.
It was a mosque
that was built in the 8th or 9th century, and we were taken to the mosque, not to enter the mosque so much, but outside the mosque was the huge slab of stone that was from the original mosque that was built. And there were words on it too, and we were visiting that stone. But in order to do that, the women had to go through another...
And that's what was the memorable thing. You know, of course, we had to be divided. So myself and the two other poets had to go through this little entrance, a little house, a room, in fact. And there were three women. And they had food in the middle of the floor. And they were so happy to see us. And we were so happy. We started laughing immediately because we had to get into the black niqab. You know, and okay, so we started kind of laughing a little bit because it was very hot outside. And the women laughed with us because they thought it was ridiculous to see us in this outfit. That was the whole point. Out we went into the big open space and it was terrifically hot. And we felt like we were in a fancy dress. It felt very oppressive. And in fact, the Turkish poet, Aytan, she hated it. She couldn't stand it because she felt this could happen in Turkey any day. So she has rushed back into the place. And Anna and I kind of followed. And she just left and went outside. And Anna and I stayed in there. They offered us food. And then with a kind of sign language, we went, God, isn't it hot? And the woman said, but sort of look at me, look what I have to wear. What do you think? How do you think I feel? And they had a few words of English, and whatever language we spoke, we really had such fun. And finally, they had to drag us out of there because we just didn't want to leave. Mm-hmm. And it was the most beautiful, intimate moment of the whole festival for me. And I wish I could have stayed there and eaten all day and talked.
I want to emphasize that this was the first time that the poets were invited. Under Saddam, there had been Al-Marbid festivals in which the poets had come from other countries. After the Gulf War, the Saddam Hussein regime was such that if you were with a foreigner, you could be tortured. You could be even killed.
Of course, Basra was one of the areas that Saddam really nailed after the festival.
That's correct. So this festival, the internationality of this festival was very important. And it was summed up. It turned out that the last day of the festival, where the other poets were going up to Baghdad, but Aggie and I, because of visa things and this thing that I said at the beginning where we first got visas to go to Washington, they rearranged our tickets, so we weren't going up to Baghdad. But it happened to have fallen on March 26th, and that was Aggie's birthday. And for Aggie's birthday, Akil Mindlawi, who is the cultural minister from Baghdad there, and he's 34 years old, a young guy, brilliant guy, and very warm, receptive, and he spoke American English very well. He arranged for a cake, which I understand someone else said he spent a lot of money to get this cake for Aggie. And it was celebrated after breakfast in the hotel dining room where we all stayed. But here was the important thing. With songs being sung in Italian, Danish, Turkish, Spanish, French, Moroccan Arab, American, and Aggie herself sang a Swedish lullaby. And that was very momentous, and it was very important for that festival. It turned out that the occasion of Aggie's birthday made possible a dimension of the internationality that was really quite wonderful in this festival.
It was beautiful, actually, because it was a total surprise to me. Yeah. You know, suddenly this table was being laid, and I thought, what are they doing? You know, because we were leaving that day. But it was the fact that we all came together, and they had, those sparklers, and it was incredible.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I thought was really exciting Well, mainly on the last day, a lot of young poets that didn't necessarily get to read, but one was publishing, for example, a newspaper, and he'd done translations of Sylvia Plath. He was dying to get hold of my book and said, please, 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 please. And I said, I haven't got it. I just had one copy, but I'll send you, you know, when I get back. And they also sent us poems back that they wanted us to maybe not necessarily translate. They were already in English, but they were very keen on that ongoing communication. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I kept in touch with a couple of them on email. So I asked them specifically, they spoke very good English. So, well, what do you think of all these older poets? And said, well, I don't particularly like the style of poetry. It's a little bit fuddy-duddy, but, you know, the message is good, but it's in an old form. We want to write in a new way. And, you know, they were very hip, actually.
So when they say a new way, not as the kind of hip-hop, spoken word kind of poetry?
No, not necessarily.
I don't think hip-hop has yet arrived there may be, it's something we may not know, because, I mean, hip-hop is known certainly to American soldiers, and there may be a dimension apart. We didn't experience it when we were there. There may be a dimension where hip-hop has migrated in Iraq.
We did see. The one only time we were allowed to walk in the street, we walked along the promenade. The
riverside. Where we
and then
the
there
river.
Was some breakdancing, actually. And it was a little bit to the side. I mean, you know, really very much with it. And even the soldiers thought this was great, you know.
So when you say soldiers, you mean the Iraqis?
Saw an American or British in the days. It had been secured by British soldiers, Basra. But we didn't see any. But we were always the car driven from the airport to the hotel. A car preceded us with men in Kalashnikovs. When we were on the bus, a car preceded us. We were always preceded. And when we walked along the riverside, we were accompanied by Iraqi security, because they certainly didn't want anything to happen to visitors from other countries. There was security everywhere, and a woman or a man even could not just go out into the street by him or herself. And that was why the problem was when I read at the university, because I thought that it was part of the festival, but it wasn't. And that immediately brought up the question of security.
But they were the soldiers, the young soldiers, they were mainly very young.
Yeah.
They were very excited about us being there.
Oh,
they
yes.
wanted to pose for photographs. They took photographs.
I think also this needs to be noted. At the halls, we read at the Petroleum Cultural Center Hall, the big workers' hall. We also read at Martyrs' Hall, Shuhada. Shuhada was another hall. We also saw the National, we read after the National Symphony. And we should mention that National Symphony, because it was really quite extraordinary. That was on the second day at the evening session. This was Altaba bin Ghazwan Hall on the second day of the festival. We all were treated to a stirring Mendelssohn and Tchaikovsky by the National Symphony Orchestra, brilliantly conducted by Karim Wasfi.
That was deeply moving, actually.
Yes, but here's the thing that I want to mention. In the corridors, in both of these halls, there were three halls, in the outer spot is an incredible activity, especially a petroleum hall. For example, Agneta was interviewed 9 times by different people. Everything is opening up. That was part of this international. Everything wants to be opened up. People were interviewing all the poets, huge books, and you know that Iraq was, prior to the war, was considered the center of book publishing in the Middle East. they published an enormous amount of books. And now you saw tables again with books, yeah. with an enormous amount of books coming out. Well, most of these are in Arabic, and they weren't in English, but they're publishing, publishing again. Yeah. And newspapers are being published. I do want to say this also. There was the communist newspaper, there's a daily communist newspaper now, but there was a weekly. And the weekly, Sabah Jassim said to me, I think a little proudly, he said, it's called The People's Road. He said this to me because he last year, after something I said in an email, that he translated, or I said that the Song of the Open Road, I regard it as the greatest American poem ever written, the one by Walt Whitman, and he translated it and published it last year. And then in this newspaper which started up, which was the communist, one of the communist newspapers, it's called The People's Road, and he made it, I think he was trying to suggest that the title came from also the translation that he did of Whitman's poems.
The other thing, they also had an art exhibition. And I was really unexpected to me the kind of art that they showed, because it was very, very contemporary. There was one little incident actually before the festival, which I had wrote a poem about. There was one poet on his way to Al Mabit Festival, and he died on the train. And he had his one poem, because all the Iraqi poets read only one poem. So he really wanted me to, he asked me if I could write a little poem in memory of him. He was an old man, and in his little briefcase was his poem that was never read. Very beautiful kind of symbol of the festival in a sense, because people just adore poetry in Iraq. The hunger for it is extraordinary.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, but I want to give you the opportunity first to say one last thing that really struck you or that you think people here outside of Iraq should know.
Well, for me, it would be that actually being there took away a lot of fear I had, but it also reinforced the fear of what the occupation and all these wars have done to the people of Iraq, and particularly to the women. I think it's much easier to be a man in Iraq than it is to be a woman, for sure. But we also have been asked to come back again, and I just can't wait, because I want to see it again with the knowledge I have of having been there.
I was very eager to go to Iraq to meet finally Sabah Jassim, but also to be with the Iraqi people and to participate in what was the opening, this internationalism that came with the Al Mabit of 2010. And when we had the bad news about Jafar Hajwal, who was that poet who died on the train, we were able to overcome that by integrating it. And Aggie read that poem that she wrote for him. Mm-hmm. And all in all, it was a wonderful meeting. And we felt that we had participated in something that was truly momentous.
And this is Raising Sand Radio, and I'm Susan Gallimore. We just heard from Jack Hirschman and Agneta Falk, who traveled to Basra recently. They were there at the end of March, where they were invited to share their poetry and mix and mingle with poets from all over the world, as well as the Arab world. And we're grateful to have their point of view. We're going to go out with Bob Marley and Get Up, Stand Up.
Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Most people think great God will come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you will look for yours on earth. And now you see the light, you stand up.